Rajiv Jain Vijayji. Your book, Snakes in the Ganga, has its second part focusing on the Western education system, targeting Hinduism and Indian students in particular. Now, with the powerful backing that renowned international universities such as Harvard has, how do you think students can play a role in bringing back non-distorted Sanatan Dharam? And Vijayji, please feel free to add your insight as well.
So you want to go first or?
So I think students in the US, Hindu students in particular, lack the support that other communities have. You have the Jewish community has the Hillel Center. There are other institutional mechanisms that are there that support Hindu students. I mean, the different other religious minorities or students that are in the university system. Whereas Hindu students do not have a support system in the university system, neither do they have the right background from their education at home or from schooling. So the Hindu parents have actually let their kids go and have submitted them to an institution like the school or the government or social media to educate their kids on Hindu identity. And of course, they have been hijacked. The Hindu kids' minds have been hijacked by others. And the parents then, after, you know, a decade later, they do not know how to relate with their kids. They have, in fact, many Marwari homes talk about the next generation saying, here, you know, we used to do all these things traditionally, but our kids have, they just don't connect with the same kind of values. So in the Western university system, this is just exacerbated even more. And the Hindu students just are like driftwood. They just go along with every new social theory that's put on them. They kind of go along with it. In fact, we're doing an interview on Infinity Foundation channel, which will be aired very soon, on how wokeism has affected Hindu families in America. And that's something that, you know, I would urge your viewers to watch, because it talks about how deep this problem is and how once the kids have been hijacked, there's just no getting them back. Because Hindu parents take, you know, Indians go through immense sacrifice to leave the homeland and then go overseas and go through the immigration process and get jobs and educate their kids. And just so much sacrifice goes into the next generation. And at the end of, you know, two or three decades, they just come out as paupers because they've lost their next generation. So this is a very sad thing that's happening. And this interview will be a wake-up call to many, many Indian parents saying that we better buck up and do something about it.
Definitely. Thank you. In your book, you use the term Breaking America 2.0. Can you give a little background on what you mean by that?
So, you know, Breaking America is sort of a takeoff on my earlier book called Breaking India, which talked about how there are cleavages in society, ideologies, and these can break up a country conceptually, emotionally and mentally break up. It's not a physical breakup. Now, the same thing is happening in the United States because of wokeism. Wokeism is a Breaking America strategy, and it is actually working because the extreme left wing, which is called progressives of the Democratic Party, are going into wokeism in a big way. And then the extreme right of the Republican Party is totally against it. And there's no middle ground. And so this is the Breaking America syndrome. The wokeism is bringing a cancel culture, so you cannot even argue with them because you come from the wrong, you are the oppressor and you can't argue with them. And they've designated themselves as a protected category, meaning we are protected because we are the oppressed. And so, you know, you being the oppressor don't have equal rights, we have better rights than you to compensate for what happened in the past. So this is a weird sort of a thing. And it's a Marxism, because in Marxism you have oppressors and oppressed, but they are economic. In critical race theory, it's race. And so taking Marxism and applying it to race means that the following: all the old structures of society, whatever made America great, was the result of whites being in domination. So they made it for themselves. And therefore, all the old structures have to be dismantled. And this is a hell of a lot, you know, to dismantle. So if you're a white person and you say, look, I haven't done anything wrong, tell me what I did wrong, not anybody else, but what did I do wrong? The answer will be, you don't have to have done anything wrong to be a white supremacist. The fact that you're born white, you're enjoying white privilege because those structures still exist. So if the person says, okay, now what do I have to do in order not to be a white supremacist? They have to say, well, you join us and fight the other whites, fight the structures, dismantle the structures. Unless you are dismantling the structures of your ancestors, you're still being a white supremacist. So this is pretty intense. Obviously, Americans are not the kind of people who just sit back and take it. They're going to fight back, and they are. So that's breaking America as a civil war. It's not North versus South. It's a new kind of a civil war of wokeism versus people who feel that they're being rational. They want to have meritocracy. I think an important point people don't understand is that wokeism is against traditional liberalism. It's against traditional liberalism. The liberalism of Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy was equal rights, equal opportunities, not that you have to have equal outcomes. Equal outcomes means that, you know, if X percent of the population in a certain place are blacks, then X percent of this job, that job, that job should also be blacks. So, you know, but you don't want someone to be doing surgery on you just because they were the right kind of race or identity and they got that job. You want that the best surgeon should be based on merit. You want that as a consumer, yeah. Right? You don't want the pilot flying the plane got that job. He didn't qualify, but he was the right race, so he got in. You don't want that. Now, the argument is also bogus because it doesn't work equally for everybody. When they say Asians, there are too many Asians who qualify to get into Harvard if you did it on merit. In fact, Harvard concluded that 43% of all admissions would end up being Asian if they did strictly on merit without restrictions. But they want less than half of that to be Asians. So they artificially lowered the quota of Asians, and therefore it's not based on merit. Yeah. Right? But why not apply the same thing to sports? Why couldn't we say there are too many blacks in basketball in proportion to their population? And there are too many blacks in football and in sports in general. And there are too many blacks in the pop culture and media, music and entertainment and your field of, you know, acting and all of that in proportion to their population. So why don't we say that they are the oppressor? Because there are too many of them, so they must be the oppressor. And therefore these structures, the way you play basketball favors tall people. And that means because you are tall, you've made those rules. And therefore we have to dismantle those rules and we got to put the basket low so that a short guy like me can also play basketball. Why don't we say, let's change the rules of the game? I'm serious. No. Why don't we change the rules of the game where blacks are doing well? Because we can say you are doing well, therefore it's oppression. Yeah. And you're oppressing against Asians who are short and you are tall. And so you made these rules and that's unfair. So if too many Asians getting in on math and science is considered oppressiveness, and they have to be held back artificially, then you should also apply the same logic to sports and entertainment. Sure. But of course, nobody wants to listen to this. I've raised this issue, there's not a single answer, they'll just cancel me and keep me, silence the mic. And that's what happened. So this is why many Indians have actually now joined the fight against wokeism. Yeah. Vivek Ramaswamy is one of them, okay. Who's joined. He's just announced that he wants to run for president. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's pretty serious, but I think he wants to make a point. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So this is breaking America. This is what breaking America is all about. And Indians need to understand how to interpret America's weirdness that's happening in the last few years. And that's because of this breaking America syndrome.
And especially in the education system. So in America now, everything is test optional. So there are no objective criteria for entering the undergraduate program, and it's entering even the graduate school application. Mm-hmm. So SAT is not required, APs are not considered. So what are they going to base it on? So they're going to base it on these woke criteria. The rubric of assessment of an application is going to be upon critical race theory ideas on who is marginalized, who they think is marginalized and oppressed. So everything is going to be on this oppressor-oppressed lens, and it's going to devastate the academia in the US, and these ideas, right, are being you know, exported to India. So these same universities are coming to India. We are embracing them without doing due diligence on what's working in America. Is it working well? What are the criteria? How do they select students? Are they really good? Are liberal arts really good? What are they producing? Are they are the students that come out of these social sciences and humanities programs, are they worth anything? Do they bring value to the economy? Are they employable? Are they skilled? Because they are not. In America, we find that, you know, they have a huge debt burden and they can't get employment, and they're all sitting in their parents' basement. And we're bringing this to India, which is unfortunate.
That's true. Now, being an actor in the entertainment industry, I'm familiar with the stereotypical roles that we're given. How do you think the way Indians are represented in film and television affects the perception we have about Hinduism and Indian culture?
So I think the problem is not only in the United States, but also in Bollywood. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see a Bollywood, you see a guy with a tilak, and clearly he's being symbolized as a Hindu, and he's a crook. And then he goes to this father in a church, and the father is a really soft-spoken, nice, peaceful guy, loves everybody and solves their problem. And even the actor and actress says, now let's go here because father will solve our problem, like that. So basically, Hindus are a problem, Christianity is a solution. Or the Muslims are good guys, Hindus are against them. So this sort of thing has happened because of the soft Islam, soft Christianity influence in Bollywood. And that's, people have written about it. It's very different from when I was young, the Kapoors, the Raj Kapoor type people, were the rulers of Bollywood, right? So it was very patriotic. You listen to all the old Raj Kapoor songs, they would not qualify today. They would be called, you know, Saffron and all. I'm sure Raj Kapoor would be called a Saffron Hindu nationalist today by his own grandchildren. So now Raj Kapoor's children, grandchildren, gradually every generation became more and more de-Hinduized, secularized, first de-Hinduized, secularized, then Islamized, many of them married to Muslims. And they have children with names like Timur, who was a conqueror, Muslim conqueror who came here. They have children like that. So, you know, the problem is not in America only, it's also right here. Mm-hmm. And those who fight back, the few filmmakers who kind of fight back, are branded as sort of Hindu fanatics or something like that. When all they're trying to do is get the space back, which used to be our space. And should be our space because we're a majority. And so I don't believe there should be stereotyping of anybody. I would be equally concerned if there's a stereotyping of a Muslim or a Dalit or a Christian. It should not happen. But that doesn't mean that you solve one problem by creating another problem. So I don't think that they should stereotype my tradition, and I don't want to stereotype their tradition. I believe in mutual respect.
Very true.
Yeah. So we need to challenge all this bias. And this one bias fighting another bias, kind of reverse bias, is not the way forward. So there ought to be, people should be able to play, Indians in the US media should be able to play characters other than being some tech worker or some doctor type or a taxi driver or a convenience store, 7-Eleven, you know, person at the cash register. Those are stereotype roles.
I also think we can learn a lot from what happened to Disney. Mm-hmm. So over the last couple of years, Disney World, the company, Walt Disney Company, which is located in Florida,
yeah,
came under attack because they were very carefully injecting these woke ideas on transgender ideology into their characters. And the Florida governor, you know, went after them and said, we don't want any of this woke nonsense. And their privileges, they get some tax benefits and things like that in Orlando. So those will be cut. And it caused a huge, media frenzy because they said somebody's actually attacking Disney. Because media is a powerful vehicle through which all these ideas come in. So Indians also can learn from, people like Governor DeSantis, as to how to fight back when media has certain biases, wants to indoctrinate young children with certain ideologies, which is against, the ethos of the people. So, and we should also scrutinize Disney and see what they're doing in India, mm-hmm, because this is, India is for sale. So
So, you know, you as an actor know the importance of subtle, unconscious messages, memes.
Yeah.
And you can convey a lot through that. So when you're writing, when you're doing China, then you talk about these Chinese make beautiful, there are beautiful movies about the greatness of China. Yeah. You know, and there are these slumdog millionaires, which is just the opposite for India. You know, and so in China, if they make a movie which is all about, you know, violence against Tibetans and Uyghur Muslims, you are not going to have, you know, Oscars, and you're not going to have the Chinese people loving it.
In fact, it's the reverse, right? Tom Cruise had some Taiwanese something, and they made him remove it.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. Whereas in India, the public doesn't seem to mind. You know, if they hate, it's almost like self-hatred. That's very strange. Now, this morning I had just before I came for this interview, met a famous Indian theater person. She's a director of a lot of theater. And so she's been a friend of ours for like decades. And so she's telling me how her show on Buddha has done really well, gone all over the world. And how it's, I asked her, which version of Buddha? Is it the traditional story? Or is it the way it's been appropriated by the Ambedkarites? And she didn't know anything about the Ambedkarites. So she said, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. So I told her that the Ambedkar started a movement to champion the Dalits and move them from Hinduism into Buddhism. Okay, because he felt Hinduism is biased, and he'll move them into Buddhism, he'll get social justice. That's fine. But in doing so, he removed the Four Noble Truths, which is the foundation of Buddhism, and the Eightfold Path, which is meditation. And he argued that we don't need meditation, all that hocus pocus we don't need, and we just need to call ourselves Buddhists and start becoming very active, aggressive fighters. So he's turned Buddhism from a meditation system into a system of kind of really aggressive fighting, which is a distortion of Buddhism. And many Buddhists feel that way. Many real Buddhists feel that these Ambedkarites are not real Buddhists. And Ambedkar himself was not a proper Buddhist. He was a great man in many other ways. But as far as his attitudes towards Buddhism are concerned, that's all fraud. So I told her, I said, why don't you add one more scene at the end of your play, in which there is this debate between an Ambedkarite who says, now we reject all of this stuff that you've seen. That is not Buddhism. We're going to go fighting, and we're going to do this and that, and then let there be a debate with somebody else who comes from the real Bodhisattva, or somebody who speaks like the Dalai Lama, because Dalai Lama doesn't accept this new distorted Buddhism either. So why don't you do that? And she said, oh, but that then I won't get all the sponsorship. So she's scared, after understanding that this would be a brilliant theater, because in theater you bring out provocations. So you're also using theater to bring out, to provoke people into thinking that this tradition of Buddha that I've been talking about has now been hijacked. But she's scared to do that. So these are some of the issues that are in your industry. You are the theater guy. And so it's for people like you to take the initiative and create very sophisticated, not in the face kind of messages, but very sophisticated messages that bring it back into a balance.
Definitely. Definitely. Thank you so much for that. Now, my next question is, what impact will the unfair treatment of Hinduism in the Western Academy have on India's economy, considering the large number of Indian students being trained by Westerners who practice Hindu phobia?
So I think there is implicit bias against people in India who are too Hindu. An industrialist who goes around, that may be one of the reasons the billionaires are funding it, because, you know, at home they're very Hindu. And internationally, they need funding, they need investment, they need joint ventures, they need licenses. And so they're trying to, bribe the left, if you will, bribe the left by funding them so that it'll help their image a little bit. But I feel that if Hinduism is tagged as something that is against social justice, that's a retrograde faith, then it is going to affect people's attitude towards investing in a very Hindu organization. You know, a good example is Arabs are wearing their Arab dress, and they're out there in the world doing business. They're very proud of it. But how many Hindu industrialists, billionaires going around in international circles will wear a tilak or will wear a Hindu symbol? Hardly ever. Women no longer wearing saris. because it, in my mother's generation, everybody wore a sari. But now it's like, it's taboo, so let's not wear it because you don't know what they might say. So gradually we're receding our symbols, and we are doing, we are putting these symbols more and more into a very safe place called a temple, our Hindu mandir, or home, but not out in the public. So this is an effect we're having.
But Rajiv, you know, 5 years ago, I was in the Vodafone office in Chennai. Mm-hmm. And very interesting, early morning when you go, the woman that is sweeping is in a sari. That's the uniform, the official uniform that Vodafone has given them. The woman that holds the door, you know, to let people in because it's an AC office, she wears a salwar kameez with a beret. And then the women that sit there solving your problems of, you know, talk time and this and that, you know, doing the admin, wear in the Madras heat, wear a scarf, a polyester shirt, a tight trouser with leather shoes. It's just stifling to just see them, right? Yeah. And so one of the women I asked, her name was Mahalakshmi. I said, hey, how, you know, your name is Mahalakshmi. How? Why don't you have a tilak like a Mahalakshmi? You know, that'll complete the picture. I was just saying that in jest. And she said, that's against HR policy, ma'am, to wear a tilak. Vodafone office in Chennai.
Really?
I'm not joking.
Oh my God. Wow.
And the lady's name was Mahalakshmi. And she said, I would love to do it, but the HR policies don't allow for this.
So, you know, being Hindu is considered communal in India. Mm-hmm. Being Muslim is considered secular. Yesterday, or day before, I was at the Vivekananda International Foundation, mm-hmm. and I gave a talk. And we were talking about international standards. And so I was complaining that the standard for yoga internationally is being controlled by a bunch of white guys in New York called Yoga Alliance. They've created a group called Yoga Alliance, and they've come up with the standards of yoga, how it's going to be done and all, and they're internationalizing. They're giving certificates for yoga teacher training, and according to their teacher training, in their all their manuals and all that, their idea of yoga and its history and all that is what they're doing. And they've also convinced the World Health Organization their standards of yoga. And the World Health Organization is coming to India with its standards, and we are following it. So I was saying that. So one guy stood up and said, I'm a Muslim and I object to this, and we are 16% of India, and I object to this because this is, he didn't use the word, this is communal, he said that. Now later on, I didn't have a chance to respond because the moderator, and he didn't give me enough time. But later on, I saw him over having coffee in the hall. So I brought the video guy. I said, please, let's have a conversation. So what I told him is, you control the definition of halal, not Hindus. So I control the definition of yoga. So I have no problem if Muslims control the definition of halal, because that's your culture. Yeah. I have no problem with it. Mm-hmm. Halal, you guys can control the definition. Why do you have a problem controlling the definition, our people controlling the definition of yoga? And he tried to fudge out of it. He said, oh, no, Pakistan says this. I said, are you a Pakistani agent? You stood up and said, this is against your religion. So, you know, people need to speak out. People, you speak out, logic, clearly, give them their due, tell them that I respect what you're doing, it's okay for you, but you have to respect what I'm doing, it's okay for me. I'm not imposing on you, and I don't want you to impose your halal on me. So, you know, if we have talking points, that's why we've come out with this book called Varna Jati Caste. It's a new book. Just a few days, 2-3 days ago, we came out with it. Wow. And I wish we had a sample here. Varna Jati Caste. We are both authors of it. It's available online. There's a Kindle edition available. It's just 200 rupees or something. It's a very simple 150-page book, which gives you talking points how to argue back on
these
kind of things.
That's very good. That's very, very good. Yeah. Wow. Now, Vijayaji, for hundreds of years, the prevalent issue of distorting Sanatan Dharam can be seen in history, right? How could the Gen Z prepare themselves to fight this backlash and humiliation and build a strong culture, a foundation for themselves? Because a lot of times what we see in Indian kids born in the West, or those who have transferred to America, is often they shy away from their religion and traditions. Now, what do you have to say to them?
So one is first understanding, for example, this book, Varna Jati Caste, is a toolkit for Hindus to answer back, like Rajiv Ji said. The other thing one has to realize is you have to understand the other side before you can respond. For example, you know, Suraj Engide, whom we critique his ideas in this book, he goes to University of Pennsylvania with a bunch of Indian kids and he's giving a lecture. So you understand that parents are spending $250,000 for a four-year education at the University of Pennsylvania. And this is the lecture and indoctrination that their kids are getting. Where Suraj Engde says that your parents are casteists, right? And the only way that you accept this and get out of this, right, to be an anti-casteist, like how there's a guy called Kendi, a black American scholar, who talks about anti-racism and how to be an anti-racist. Right, that's his thing. So Yengde, of course, maps that on to caste and says, how do you guys be anti-casteist? So he tells the young adults there that you need to sever relationship with your parents because this caste privilege is passed on from one generation to another and your parents are actively passing on this to you. And the only way you fight it is to sever ties with your own parents. And that's how you become an ally. So it is not virtue signaling, but you have to actually be an ally by severing ties.
So it's like you have to dismantle structures because those structures are reproducing abuse.
Yeah.
One of the structures is family, a Hindu family. Mm-hmm. Indian family is a structure which reproduces, you know, bias and oppression from one generation to the next. Mm-hmm. They teach you oppressiveness in your family. You don't have to learn in books or anywhere else. It doesn't have to be part of the law. Your parents are teaching you how to be a biased person. That's the nature of Hindu family. Because of the way they treat people and all that stuff, they're all biased and Hindus are a bunch of bigots and all that. So the Hindu family must be dismantled.
And the way you do it is you sever ties. They're telling young kids who are 20, 20.
Disown your family.
That's how you be an ally. That's how you be an anti-casteist. And here are the parents are spending $250,000 to get this education so the kids can sever.
And that's all written in this book. We've quoted you.
That's amazing. That's so important for this generation.
Yeah.
To be honest. Now you talk about Harvard and cancel culture in the Harvard Business School chapter of Snakes in the Ganga. How does Harvard take control of its alumni even after they graduate without students even realizing it?
So Harvard has got such a networking. If you are a Harvard alumni, you should belong to all their clubs and wherever you go, there are Harvard chapters and they keep you connected through networks and newsletters and activities, alumni activities, and it's good for your career. So that's why you are loyal to them. You pay your dues and you give them all the money and all that because it's sort of like the most elitist club. And you earn your place in that club. And if you have your Gmail or your email ID at harvard.edu for life, that's pretty cool. So there are many ways you can go around throwing your weight in your name, that name dropping, I'm from Harvard and all that stuff. And you're part of the alumni. They'll all help each other. So these are ways that Harvard continues building its brand. And when the brand is good, you can get away with bullshit. You can just say whatever and people will buy it because it's the Harvard brand.
And speaking of privilege, right, this is the most hypocritical, structure of privilege that they've established. Mm-hmm. That only, Harvard people get special status and they are some special human beings. And they control all kinds of institutions all over the world. So it's sort of hypocritical for people who talk about privilege and structure and oppressor versus oppressed and all of that. It's kind of ironic.
Definitely. Now, it's evident also that Vedic system is designed to help a diverse society of individuals to pursue their goals and the fourfold system, artha, kama, dharma, moksha, organize those goals. Do you think Western influence is distorting this system or forcing people to believe that this is all a mythology so they can distract from the dharma?
Yeah, well, it is. The best proof that the Vedic system is very good for diversity is the fact that India has the maximum diversity in the world. Nobody doubts that. If you look at how many diverse languages, ethnicities, ways of eating, dressing, type of food you eat, type of deity, which deity you worship, if you look at all the criteria of diversity, The West is highly homogenized by comparison. Yeah, Japan is homogenized. China is homogenized. India is the most diverse country in the world. So first we have to establish that. Then you have to say that you guys, scientific people, are always looking for old structures that have caused problems. Well, let us tell you the old structures caused diversity. So let's give credit. Let's give credit where it's due. Okay, so we have problems and we should fix those, but we also have a huge asset base, which is diversity. And if you think that it adds to the robustness of a society, the fairness and the social justice to have diversity, then you have to credit the Vedic system, which produced so much diversity. How did it come about? I mean, how else? It didn't drop from the sky. I mean, you say, okay, did Muslims bring diversity? Well, no, because you look at wherever else they went. There's no diversity. Did Christians bring diversity? No, they destroyed all sorts of things. Right. So you cannot say that this was some kind of an imported idea from somewhere else. Somehow, our society in India had the ability to nurture diversity and mutual respect, which is our society is living proof of what I'm saying. So it's not like my kind of a chauvinistic claim. You can measure for yourself. There is no way people would be able to refute the statement that India has the maximum diversity in the world. So if you believe in the old structures are the cause of all the stuff that's going on, good or bad, then you have to give credit to this. So I would say that a proper understanding of Vedic culture and its relationship to diversity is called for. And it ought to be a topic that people teach. When they have a diversity department in HR, which all big companies have, and they have diversity training in universities and in HR, and there are a lot of consultants. Why don't they study the Vedic model of diversity?
Because after all, it produced the results.
Yeah.
And there is no pressure, right? The Punjabi is as proud of his kala dal or whatever as the South Indian of his or her rasam. There is so much pride in the identity of Indians. Yeah, because the identity is based on solid things, not tangible things. So there's no pressure for anyone to convert to anything else, or to Tamilian has no pressure to become a Punjabi. Punjabi has no, necessity or feels some kind of inadequacy to become a Tamilian.
Although she's becoming half Punjabi already. we can say that. She's becoming half Punjabi.
I was going to say the other way around, but anyway.
No. Definitely. Now, my last but not least question is that, can you give some depth on how Harvard University is breaking up the Indian family system and what their long-term goal is?
So, as we said earlier, the people like Suraj Jengde from Harvard are going around teaching Indian students, and we have it on film, that they should boycott Indian family structure. And the logic is that Indian families are a structure that teach abusiveness. This is a weird thing. That Indian families, mothers, fathers, they teach their kids abusiveness, casteism, superiority complex, that you are better than this and that, biases, prejudices. So they are perpetuating social injustice. So one of the things you have to do to fight social injustice and bring about social justice is to dismantle the Indian family system. That's pretty serious stuff. And Harvard has allowed such discourse or encouraged such discourse without proof. I mean, you would think a responsible thing would be to go and conduct some kind of a statistical database and see what is the bias level in Indian Hindu families and Muslim families and Jewish families and all kind of families, and see if it is indeed the case that Hindu families are especially biased. I wouldn't think that would be the case. But without any evidence and proof, without any peer reviews, such articles and such scholarship perpetuates, because it's the Harvard brand name. And that's very dangerous for India.
See, the other thing is, the ideas from Harvard also come to India. Ashoka University prides itself in being the Harvard of India. And what they are doing through their gender studies department, it's called Gender and Sexuality Studies department, is, and they're very proud about it, because they say India has only gender studies, whereas we have gender and sexuality studies. So with the addition of sexuality studies, they're bringing in Western ideas of queer theory into Ashoka. So they have conferences in Ashoka and they brainwash young children. Again, they're paying 10 lakhs a year for 4 years, 40 lakhs for this undergrad education in gender studies or other liberal arts curriculum, where they teach the children that, for example, they endorse that pornography should be a vital part of education. They have, you know, they bring in so-called experts from these shady organizations called Kinky Collective, where they all practice kinky sex. And they bring these people in as experts to teach Ashoka University students that kinky sex has a role. Because again, these are structures established by men under patriarchy, and so we need to break them. So they are brainwashing. It's like thought reform. They're brainwashing young adults into these sorts of things. And if this doesn't break family, what does? Godrej Culture Labs, on the other hand, also brings these ideas of queer theory into something called the Godrej Culture Lab, which is a sort of a funky place that provides entertainment and discussions in Mumbai, where young people are attracted to these kinds of, you know, very trendy places, where they discuss these kinds of things and promote and indoctrinate the youth. So all this, what it does is it breaks society. It tells the youth that what your parents are doing is not correct, and you need to disengage, decouple, and sort of commit to these kinds of ideologies if you want to be a global citizen of today. So this is also another way that ideologies coming out of Harvard is pervading Indian society and breaking the Indian.
And the Indian government has opened the floodgates and invited foreign Ivy Leagues to set up campuses in India with no restrictions on what they'll teach. So all these things we are fighting over there are going to come and be taught here. And no restrictions on who can be a professor, on their salaries, on their qualifications, nothing. Whereas Indian universities are regulated by the University Grants Commission. So the government has regulations on who you can hire, what type of credentials are needed, what is the syllabus you can teach, what are the courses you are allowed, and what's the salary structure, all that for Indian universities. But foreign universities are allowed without restrictions, which means that we've actually made it easier for them to come and compete and take over market share from Indian universities. Now, what could be more stupid than that?
It's open season on Indian, you know, youth.
I mean, it would be one thing if they said that they can come and compete on the level playing field on the same rules as Indian universities. Even better would be if they said they can come and teach those topics where we need help, like technology, but they're not going to teach Indian history and Indian religion because we don't need their help. That would make sense. That's what China has. Yeah. Right. So this is thoughtless policy. Just a few weeks ago, this happened.
Wow. Thank you so much for coming here. It's been such an honor. I really hope that the people that are watching get a copy of Snakes in the Ganga, because what you're talking about is something that this generation, and at least the youth of today, definitely needs. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Namaste.
Namaste. Of course.